Welcome to another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our guest today is drag diva Scarlett Daly, better known as Scott Blunt. So welcome to the show, Scott.
Thank you for having me, Art.
You're quite welcome. It's going to be an interesting stroll down memory lane. I understand a lot of people who are aware of you know you as Scarlett Daly. And Scarlett had a 32-year career on the drag stage. So I'm sure you visited quite a few bars in that period.
I did. I was very blessed to have traveled in 29 states in Mexico. I took this opportunity as a child of being in theater and plays in school and wanted to do something further. And my second time ever in a club, I saw a drag show and I was like, what's going on here? And they're like, these are guys dressed up as women. And I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. And then a friend said, I bet you could do that. And I was like, I don't know. But I gave it a shot. My second time in a gay bar, I was in a dress.
Alrighty then. So one of the first bars you told me you wanted to talk about is a bar that I'm familiar with from my research. And it was a place called the Paddock Club, which was located in Greenville, North Carolina. Yes, there is a Greenville, North Carolina. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Paddock Club?
Yeah, the Paddock Club was started in the early 70s, like 1970, and it was the home of the very first Miss North Carolina pageant for female impersonators. I was born and raised in Eastern North Carolina, which is about 45 minutes from Greenville, where East Carolina University is. So that was our closest gay bar east. The closest gay bar west was Raleigh. So I really jumped in and kind of felt a welcoming experience. It was in the alleyway. It was very typical of what gay bars were back in the 70s and even the late 70s and early 80s, where you would have to be buzzed in and kind of given the third degree to see if you knew where you were. And when I went, I just felt I had arrived, and I got to meet lots of interesting people. And after seeing the shows, I said, I'm going to enter an amateur night. Well, they didn't have amateur nights, but once a year. So my first time ever on stage was in 1981 in the Miss Gay Greenville pageant. That was the only way to get started. And I had really no guidance. I got my first dress from the JCPenney catalog and threw myself together. And there was 11 contestants and I was 10th in overall. The MC did, and the manager, he said, you've got a lot of work to do if you want to do this. And so I kind of got a drag mom and got some guidance and then went back the next year and entered Miss Greenville and was first runner up. That was a goal that I had, was to be Miss Greenville, North Carolina, America. I was born and raised, per se, in the Miss Gay America system, being the Miss North Carolina for female impersonators. And the Paddock Club was the longest running gay club under the same owner, Bill Brock, for many, many years. And Glenn Haddock, who ran the front door, he was also the MC of the drag shows on Friday nights. So they kind of took me under their wings, and I was kind of the underdog and worked really hard and studied the art form and started traveling around entering pageants. And because back then you couldn't get a booking unless you had a title and somebody knew who you were. So it took many years work from 1981 to 1985 before I won my first title. I would be first runner-up in almost every contest I would enter. And then finally, I got it together.
All right, then. And what was that first pageant that you won?
The first pageant I won was, I threw myself into a new system. It was called the Miss Gay World Pageant. And it was the Miss North Carolina World Preliminary. And it was held in Jacksonville, North Carolina, which was where Friends Lounge was. And so I entered it. When I got there, and I was like, oh, I don't have a snowball's chance in hell of winning, because there was great entertainers in the contest, like Lauren Colby, Darlene Duncan, Kelly Ray, several others. And I was a little intimidated, but I was very consistent across the board. And so my very first title, I never won a city pageant, in 1985, was Miss North Carolina World. And I was just second in every category, except for male interview, which was always my strong category. And I did win that. So when they told me that you've won the pageant, they announced it, you know, half the bar was in shock. The other half were friends and supporters were jumping up and down and happy for me. And then at the end of the evening, they said, well, now you've got to prepare to go to Miss Gay World. And I'm like, here I was, you know, first runner up in 15 pageants over the course of a few years. And I'm like, how am I going to do a national title pageant? So fortunately, Miss Gay World was held in Durham, North Carolina. Excuse me. And but the sticker was, or I should say the kicker was, the pageant was 1 week from the night that I won Miss North Carolina.
Wow. That's a quick turnaround.
And so we had a good pageant package together. And my, quote, drag mom was Brandy Alexander, who passed away a few years ago, was just legendary in the art of female impersonation. And he said, keep everything like you've got it. Go to Miss Gay World and wear this gown. And he was the reigning Miss World at the time. So I entered the contest. And when I got there, there was, I think there was 21 contestants that year. And I was up against living legends such as Dina Jacobs, Carmen Del Rio from Texas, Lauren Colby. Just it goes on and on and on. And I just did the best that I could do. And when they were calling out the awards, one contestant would win evening gown, one would win talent. And so it was down to the last category. And I was standing there as Miss North Carolina in North Carolina at the Miss World pageant, and kind of feeling a little sad because I didn't think I had placed or even much less would win. And so when they called out the fourth runner-up, third runner-up, and on up to first runner-up, and then they announced the winner, and they said, your winner is contestant number four, Scarlett Daly. Half the bar was in shock. And then all of a sudden, people just started screaming and yelling because I really had kind of a strange talent. I did a wedding scene of It Should Have Been Me into What I Did for Love, and I killed the whole wedding party, and then I got electrocuted singing What I Did for Love. So well, I took that opportunity and I said, I have a key in my hand, and I said, I've got to make something of myself here. And so I started traveling.
So what was the Paddock Club like, the actual facility? Was it a big club? Was it dark or bright, or what was it like?
It was a dark club, low light. It was in the back of an appliance store. You went in the back door, and inside it had a mezzanine and a spiral staircase. and which overlooked a dance floor and a standing area for people to watch and observe the shows or to dance. And it was home, and it there's just never been anything like the Paddock Club, right? Because so many greats started there. And to be Miss Greenville was always everybody's goal in the state, to go to the state pageant was to be Miss Greenville. So the staff and the bartenders, everybody worked together. But it was unlike everybody knew everybody's name. It's kind of like Cheers there was. So they were open Wednesday through Sundays. Friday night was show night. Everybody went to the Paddock Club. And Saturday nights, everybody would go to normally Raleigh, because that was the happening spot in the area. And it would be kind of a slow Saturday in Greenville at the Paddock Club.
Now, I've been to a number of clubs in the Carolinas back in the 80s. And I know a lot of the clubs in the Carolinas were what they called private membership clubs, which meant you could get a membership card, and in order for anyone else to come in, they either had to purchase a membership or they had to be invited in by a member. Is that the case with the Paddock Club? Was it a private membership club or no?
Yes, all North Carolina clubs were private membership clubs that served alcohol or beer and wine. So you had to be signed in by a member. And then it was a 30-day waiting period. The alcohol law enforcement, that was just one of the state alcohol rules. And so you had to be responsible if you signed somebody in, that this person wasn't going to show themselves or get yourself in trouble. And they would kick you out and your sponsors for getting you in.
Wow. Now, South Carolina at that time had the rule that they couldn't serve liquor out of an open bottle. They had to use the minis for all the drinks in South Carolina. Was that the case in North Carolina as well or no?
When I first started going to the Paddock Club, it was bring your own bottle. I was right at the age where you could go in at 18 and drink, and then they changed it to 21. And then it wasn't long after there, the BYOB laws changed, and then it was no more bring your own bottle. They would put them in cubby holes, and you'd say you were number 36, and you'd show them your little token, and then you would order your mixer, and they'd mix your drink. So it's changed a whole lot over the years. So then it became a free pour, what they call free pour state. So you didn't have to bring your own bottle in.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that, because I grew up in just outside of New York City, and then later ended up moving down to Atlanta. And so, it was always odd to me how the Carolinas had those bizarre liquor laws back then, because it seemed, I don't know, kind of a little antiquated. Like they were still remembering prohibition or something. I don't know what they were doing, but it was always interesting to me when you used to go into those bars, and each bar had its own little quirky rule about what they could do with alcohol. So how long were you in the Greenville area and focused on Paddock Club?
Well, when I turned 18, I was like, it's time to leave the nest. And so I moved to Greenville when I was 18 years old, and I lived in Greenville for about 3 years before moving to Raleigh, which was 45 miles west of the Rocky Mount area. And so it was interesting few years there. I just figured I needed to branch out to bigger venues, and I was limited to what I could really do. So I took a job in Raleigh and worked in the clubs in the Raleigh, North Carolina area up until 1985.
And that's when you won your title.
That's when I won my title. And not long after winning my title, I was contacted from a casting agency out of Wilmington, North Carolina, Ben Cannon and Associates, that they were looking for female impersonators to do a movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger, which was called Raw Deal. And it was filmed in Wilmington, but it was set in New York City. So when the beginning of the movie, when they go up to the club scene where I'm featured in, you drive up and you can see it's all New York. But when they walk in the doors, it's in a club in Wilmington called the Palladium. And the first thing you see is they're coming through and I'm on stage doing Pamela Stanley's If Looks Could Kill. And she was the hottest thing on the market right then, from Coming Out of Hiding and If Looks Could Kill. And I was like, you know, I did not have a clue. I had no film experience at all that I would even get the part. But when I went to the casting, they said, there was probably 35 of us. Everybody was in drag except myself. And I had my promo kit from Being Miss World. I'm at my 8x10 promo shots. And so they narrowed it down to two of us. And they told me, they said, you came in, you were very professional. You showed us what you could do. You didn't have to come in dressed up. So we're going to give you the opportunity to do this. And from that moment on, I was like starstruck.
Now, I just interviewed Pamela Stanley about a week ago, and she even brought that up in her interview. She even made a point of mentioning you appearing in the Raw Deal with Arnold Schwarzenegger, lip syncing to one of her songs. And she just had a huge grin on her face when she said that. So I know it was a fond memory for her, and I'm sure it was a fond memory for you.
Oh, it was. It was such, you know, when I heard her interview, it thrilled me because Pamela and I had met years earlier at a club in Raleigh, probably 1982, 83, called Sensations. And they would bring a lot of recording artists in that had a lot of dance hits at that time. And we actually met and opened the drag show that she later came out and performed. I didn't think she remembered me. And I looked a lot different from back then to what I became.
And she's going to be turning 70 this year, I think in July. And her energy is still incredible. She's amazing.
Oh, yes. When I saw your interview with her, I just felt that connection again. Her music, her voice is so still youthful. And it's, you know, that's music you always remember when you go into a club. You know, you normally heard Pamela Stanley. If you went to the clubs in the 80s, you heard her several times during the night.
Absolutely. So after all this fame in the movies and winning a national title, I understand eventually somehow you ended up at Levita's in Atlanta. What was the story behind that? How'd you end up at Levita's?
Well, I wanted a change, and I felt like you said, I had a key in my hand and I needed to open up some doors. So they were looking cast members at Levita's. It was called Levita's Home of Legends and Entertainment. It was named after a famous female impersonator in the Atlanta days, early years, Levita Allen. And it was the top female impersonation show in the United States at the time. And I worked with greats like Charlie Brown, Lily White, Tandy Andrews, Dina Jacobs, Amber Richards. So Rachel Wells reached out to me and said, hey, we need an entertainer that's very versatile and diverse with their music selections. And I always liked to make people laugh. And I did a lot of comedy. And she was like, we need something like you in our show. And would you consider it? And I was 22 years old, a national title. And I packed my bags so quick when I had that opportunity. And I headed south in a U-Haul with my cat and a goldfish. And I arrived in Atlanta and I was just amazed. We had shows at La Vida's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights. Sunday nights was a more beginners. Fridays and Saturdays were our production shows. We did shows at 11 and 1 with a cast of about 10 people that later grew into, when Tina DeVore took over show director, I think we had a cast members of about 12 people.
Now, for people who are not familiar with La Vida's, it's quite an experience. I moved to Atlanta in 1983. So I remember La Vida's extremely well. It was a little bit unusual. At that time, a number of the gay bars, particularly the show-oriented bars, were located along Cheshire Bridge Road. And La Vida's was in a kind of strip mall shopping center. To one side of it was the Terra Theater, which was the movie theater that all the gays went to on their dates and to watch movies and everything. It was right there. And La Vida's, it was opened by the people who owned Backstreet and Weekends. And they were, you know, very well known in the Atlanta market for having excellent bars that were very gay friendly. You know, they were nicely run, they were well appointed, they did everything right. And La Vida's was, I'm sure for you, a little bit of a change because it was a large space. It was not like some of the drag bars that are smaller with a compact stage area. La Vida's was in a sprawling building that had a swimming pool in one part of the building that was actually open. I mean, I remember going there to the back bar, getting a cocktail, and you could stand literally with one foot on the edge of the water watching a drag show.
That's right.
And I, as I mentioned in the interview I did some time back with Bob Taylor, who later was on the stage there at La Vida's, that it was not uncommon to see some of the drag queens after their final performance stroll over and dive in the pool.
Exactly.
So it was a very distinctive place. And they were also the home to a number of pageants. They were perfectly set up to do the preliminaries or even the national title for drag pageants because their stage and their lighting and everything was so great that it was the ideal place to do that.
Yeah, it was a magical place. It put any club, it wasn't a dance club at all. It was basically a sit down, watch your show, tables for normally 5 to 8 to 10 people. And Saturday nights you'd have to have reservations. And sometimes you would, you know, there would be a line at the door. If there was an availability, you could get in. But if you didn't have a reservation to catch the show, you'd miss out.
Yeah.
I do believe that La Vida's was originally a bathhouse.
It was. It was called, the space was divided up strangely. But the one side of it, where the swimming pool was a place called the locker room.
The locker room.
Which was like a, for lack of a better word, health club / gym / bathhouse for the gay community. And it was quite popular. And the other side of that building was a place called Hollywood Hot, which is where they did some shows and you know, drag shows and things like that, and had a regular bar. And people used to walk in, well, men, it was almost exclusively men, because locker room was a men's facility. But men would stroll over to the bar with just one of those spa towels wrapped around their waist and get a drink or hang out and try to pick somebody up. So it had quite a colorful history. And in later incarnations, it was also a gay bar for quite a while. It was called Lipsticks at one time. It was, I believe, Weekend's Warehouse was in that location as well.
Weekend Warehouse was next door to it. It was adjacent to La Vida's. When Vicky Vera and her family had that, they had Weekend's Warehouse open as well. And it was more of the men's club. And then La Vida's, we had a little door that we could scoot back behind the stage and scoot over to the warehouse if we wanted to. And at the same time, they had Backstreet and Weekend's. And many, I worked on the cast also at Weekend's. So I worked at La Vida's at 11 and 1 at night. Then I did shows at 3 and 5 a.m. at Weekend's. And we would finish our last show at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Since you brought up Weekend's, Weekend's was a favorite of mine also, because Weekend's at that time had a 24-hour liquor license.
Yes.
It was a dive of a bar. It was dark. It was dingy. It wasn't particularly fashionable or clean or glamorous. But I distinctly remember being in there and having RuPaul show up at, 4 o'clock in the morning in a pair of Daisy Duke shorts and a cutoff shirt, dancing, go-go dancing as a boy on top of a wooden cube that was probably 3 feet in all dimensions. But it was the place to go, because after all the other bars shut down at 3 o'clock in the morning, you could go to Weekend's and you could stay there forever. You never had to leave. You could just keep drinking and it was quite the environment.
Art, we probably were in that building the same time, because I remember very well, because RuPaul was my neighbor, him and Lady Bunny and Larry T. That's before they ever made it. And RuPaul was the go-go dancer and just be outrageous, but such a kind, kind soul. And Bunny was such a hoot. And Deandra Peak and Kitten with the Whip. And then they all packed up and went to New York.
When I interviewed Larry T, he was actually in Berlin when I interviewed him, but that's where he's living now, I believe. But when I interviewed Larry T, he tells the story about Larry and Lahoma and Rue all packed up in a minivan driving through the Carolinas. And I think they spent the night at Tammy Faye Baker's place. What was that called?
Heritage USA,
because they needed a place to stay that night, and that's where they ended up. So it's an interesting story. But yeah, I knew Larry and Lahoma and RuPaul casually from that time frame, seeing them out in the clubs all the time and at the celebrity club down on Ponce. And so I was familiar with the roots of the story. And yes, you're right. RuPaul at that time, he had a public ego. Everything about RuPaul, if you asked him to write his name on a piece of paper, he would say, "The world famous RuPaul, here's my phone number." Even though at that point he was basically a struggling local performer trying to make an impression somewhere.
His first LP was an underground record called Star Booty.
I can still visualize those handwritten paper flyers stapled to telephone poles in Midtown saying RuPaul and Lahoma, live on stage at Weekend's or whatever. And they would just staple them up there to get people to think that they were celebrities. And it worked.
It worked. And look where he's at now.
So that must have been quite an exciting time for you to get, from kind of smaller rural areas in North Carolina, and then to be on the big stage at probably the most fabulous show bar in the South at that time, in Atlanta, and to work with people like Charlie Brown, Amber Richards. I loved Amber Richards. She was so amazing. And so many of the other people, Rachel Wells, and a number of them had come from Sweet Gumhead, which was just down the street and had closed not long before then. So a lot of those performers were the same ones that were at the previous crown jewel of the drag world, which was only a block or so away.
And prior to that, and then after that was Illusions. That was across the street from Weekend.
Yes. I also interviewed Ted Binkley. So there's a Ted Binkley interview in the mix as well. So was there ever anything that happened at Levita's, like one memorable story, one night that you either met somebody there that you never thought you'd meet or that you had a really strange encounter with somebody? Was there anything really memorable that happened at Levita's while you were there?
Oh, wow. You would have so many celebrities come through. The first person I really remember meeting that was famous was Nancy Kelp, who was Jane Hathaway on the Beverly Hillbillies. She had come to see the drag show because she was in town for the Renaissance Festival. And I was just, all I could think was, Chief! But she was just very charming. And then I remember meeting one of the Pointer Sisters. And then I got to know Sylvester through Lady Sean, who they used to be roommates years prior. And then hanging out with them at my apartment prior to a show one evening. So getting to meet celebrities through living legends that paved the way for female impersonation, which is so different today than it was back then, because it was all about theatrics and the wow factor and the best of the best. And it was all collaborated on one stage. And everybody wanted to see it. And it was a class act show. And of course, Charlie would come in. And my mother had a fit when she knew that I was moving to Atlanta at 22 years old. So when my mom came to see my show, Charlie brings my mom up on stage and was very polite. But, you know, Charlie has known for being the bitch of the South. And she loves some good, dirty language. And so my mom, she had to get used to that right quick. But she found out that Charlie was a darling.
Yeah, he is. And he's still at it. He's still performing in Atlanta.
Right. I've just seen where he's made a comeback after health issues. And Charlie was always very kind to me. Charlie MC'd the Miss Gay World pageant when I won in 85. And that's how I got to know him. And Ron Sanford, and I were Mr. and Miss World at the same time. So it's just funny how everything came full circle. And Bertha Butt was just larger than life, and just personality, and just, you know, all these people, and Tandy Andrews, and, you know, Atlanta didn't open the doors for a lot of people until Rachel, you know, started bringing in entertainers from other states. And especially, mostly the queens came from Florida that ever worked in Atlanta regularly. But very rarely you would see people, or Texas. So it gave me the opportunity to want to see more, want to do more.
Absolutely. And, you know, a couple of the names you mentioned there, Rachel, John Greenwell, is another one that's on my hit list. I've been trying to schedule with him to do an interview. And I've known Ron for probably 40 years. I knew Ron when he lived in Nashville before he moved to Atlanta and then moved back to Nashville. So I've known Ron for a long time as well. Yeah. And he's also on that hit list to be interviewed soon. So keep your fingers crossed and we'll get them in there as well.
Well, you asked Ron about our travels all over the country and some of our controversial wild trips to New York City.
I definitely will. So how long did you stay in Atlanta? You were there for a while at La Vida's.
I was there 3 years. And then things were changing. Management change, show director change. And so I was like, well, I didn't want to come back to North Carolina. Everybody was having to cut their hours because of salaries and stuff, and or cutting their days. And so I never wanted to struggle, and I did not struggle in Atlanta. I was fortunate enough to make $150 a night, plus $200 to $400 a night in tips in 1985, which was unheard of. But when it was over, I knew it was time to move on. And I was like, well, I've done what I wanted to do in North Carolina. So I moved for a short time to Richmond, Virginia, and entered every pageant there was. If there was a pageant, I was in it.
And then eventually, at some point, after your travels to all these bars with when you were holding the title and performing in 29 states, and after living in Atlanta for a while, eventually you end up going back to Jacksonville, North Carolina.
Right. Jacksonville had Friends Lounge. It was across from Camp Lejeune Marine Base. It was off limits to Marines. And Brandy Alexander had bought the club during the 80s and offered me a job working in the shows as her MC and as a bartender. And Friends Lounge was a little cinder block, flat roof building with plastic bags stuck on the ceiling to keep the water from dripping in on you. But I'll tell you, you could not ask for a better time. And if it was off limits, the Marines, they wanted to go, especially the Marines that it was during the era of don't ask, don't tell. And the bar had been vandalized and set on fire. Brandy's house was firebombed because of being out and gay. So the military police were on witch hunts to try to find Marines that were going there and arrest them. So Brandy, being a hairdresser, she said, okay, all of us are going to get our heads shaved tonight. So we all stayed in the bar, and she probably shaved 100, 125 people's heads. And when we left, MPs were stopping all of us. And when we pulled out civilian IDs, they were like, uh-oh, we're getting ourselves in trouble. But Friends Lounge was a very welcoming and home for so many of us, and just a very special place. It wasn't glamorous. You walked in the back door and they buzzed you in. You walked down a hallway and then you walked in. There's the bar, and then there was a little stage and a tiny dressing room. But the best times of my life, I think, were probably held at Friends Lounge. And if you talk to anybody that was around in those days, would say the very same things. It might have been a dump in some people's eyes, but it was a very, Brandy or Danny Leonard, the owner, he would do anything for anybody, and he would make sure you were going to be safe. So you wouldn't have to worry about being gay bashed, which, you know, people would ride through the parking lots and just to see what was going on. And sometimes there would be problems, but nothing major, because Danny, he would take his wig off and go out there and get in somebody's face.
A lot of people don't realize that, you know, back in those days, in the 70s and 80s especially, a lot of the gay bars didn't really have signs out front. They had rear entrances that were kind of concealed or a little difficult to find. They were not places that people advertised that they were going to. It was a little off the beaten path, and a lot of times in neighborhoods that were less than glamorous. So it was a big deal even to have a gay bar in smaller towns, because so many of them didn't have them. And they became so important. You mentioned that, you know, it was like home, and that everybody was like family there. And that was really what the gay bars were all about back at that time. They were what gave us the strength to express who we really were and to be able to be the, you know, now everybody says, you know, be your authentic self. Back then, you couldn't be your authentic self. You would get fired from your job. You could get evicted from your apartment. Your family would disown you. So that was the only place you could go and feel safe and be able to express, you know, your feelings and your thoughts about your lifestyle. And so it's great that you had a place like Friends Lounge in Jacksonville to be able to do that in a town like that as well.
It was fascinating to see the military, the gay. It was amazing how many people that were in the military active that was in the closet and gay. I lived probably 5 minutes from Friends Lounge, and friends would come in town and say, oh, we're going to the club tonight. So I was like, well, get ready. When we get to the end of the street here, the back doors of the car, some people are going to open up the back doors or they're going to jump in the car. And they're like, what? And I'm like, yeah, there will be some Marine friends of mine. They can't be driving or going to the club. So they jumped into the back seat of the car, sometimes in the trunks of the cars. And we'd pull around the back and everybody would scoot inside the bar.
Yeah, it was a strange time. But we have some great stories to tell about it, and we all live through it a lot. Well, a lot of us live through it and have these stories to tell that, I don't know, it's heartwarming just to hear about experiences from all these people I've talked to about what the gay bars meant to them back then.
Yes, it was a very, you know, when I came out, our town was very narrow-minded, and it still pretty much is. I now live in Nashville, North Carolina, which is right outside of Rocky Mount. And it's still a small area, which we're 45 miles, like I said, east of Raleigh. And to get to be able to see the things and then the experience of living in Atlanta and then the AIDS scare came out, and for, you know, our spotlight man was the first person I ever knew that had AIDS. And I remember trying to help and would sit with him at Grady Hospital because his family wouldn't have anything to do with him. But also, I remember the safe sex ads and the condoms at the bar and stuff that people, they were doing in Atlanta. And when I moved back to North Carolina, I went to several club owners and say, hi, I want to talk to you about HIV and AIDS, because it's very real. I've just left Atlanta and I've seen people, one day they're alive and 6 months later they're dead. And so I asked clubs, well, can we put a fishbowl on the bar with condoms in it? Or can we put some ads for, you know, about getting tested and stuff like that? So a lot of clubs would tell me, no, it's bad for business. And later they did change their ways and started supporting it. But I was the first person in North Carolina to, the Paddock Club was the first bar that I know that allowed me to put a fishbowl on the bar with condoms in it.
Yeah, that was a big trend in Atlanta back then.
Yes.
In fact, next week, I'll be interviewing someone else you may be familiar with, Dr. Jesse Peel. And Dr. Jesse Peel in Atlanta, around the time that you were there, is the one who kind of helped get Aid Atlanta started and did a lot of activism for AIDS in Atlanta. So be interesting to hear his side of that story as well.
Oh, yes. Because if somebody went missing for a week or two, you would say, where is so-and-so? Or where's Jim? Or where's Joe? They're at Grady. And that's all you had to say. If they were at Grady, you knew what was going on.
Yeah, there were some sad times back then.
Yes, it was. And I saw kids that were 18, 19 years old, and just wide open and just invincible, they thought, and never lived to see their 21st birthday.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen quite a bit of that.
You know.
So I got to ask you, have you ever lived in a city in North Carolina that actually had the name that sounds like it's from North Carolina? Because you mentioned Jacksonville, and I think Florida. You mentioned Greenville, and I think South Carolina. You mentioned Nashville, and I think Tennessee. So do they have any cities there that are actually like belong in North Carolina, or did they just borrow the names from other states?
Well, Nashville, North Carolina, we're the original Nashville because North Carolina was one of the 13 colonies. So Nashville, Tennessee became Nashville after Nashville, North Carolina. Pam Tillis, the country singer, was here a few years ago, and we were talking. I'd gone to her show here in town, and she was like, "I never knew there was a Nashville, North Carolina." I said, "Well, we're the original." And she was like, "Well, how are you the original?" And then I had to explain to her. I said, "Well, Tennessee wasn't one of the colonies, so and we were named after General Francis Nash." And she was like, "Well, Lord have mercy," she said, "after all these years," she said, "I've just learned something new today."
All right
So
then.
and so there is I lived in Fayetteville, North Carolina, very briefly for a year in the 80s, when I was probably 82. And then there's Fayetteville, Arkansas. So for some strange reason, I end up in these towns that's got sister cities with that are bigger names, and bigger cities. So I don't know if I was a small fish in a big pond, or a big fish in a small pond, or a little fish in a big pond.
So, after all these years of entertaining, 32 years on stage, you finally hung up the wig. You do not do drag anymore, correct?
I did the last, and I've been retired from show business 10 years. 4 years ago, I did a there was a club in Durham called the Power Company, and they did a Power Company reunion at the Cotton Room, which is an events center. They talked me into doing it, and I had gained some weight. I wasn't the size I used to be. And I was just miserable. I didn't drink anymore because I was a social drinker in the bars. But I didn't drink, so I think I was the only one there sober. And I was miserable. And I said, "You know what? I came back. I did it. I'm glad I did it, but I'm miserable. I'm done." And I still have drag packed up in the buildings outside that I just need to sell. I need to get rid of.
But you found a new passion in your life after you moved back to North Carolina and hung up the drag. You kind of delved into the plant world, and you now run a
Right.
plant business in Nashville, North Carolina.
Yes. When I moved back from, I was in Wilmington, North Carolina, before I moved back to Nashville. My mother is elderly, and she's 87 years old, and I needed to be back home to take care of her. So I moved back here 15 years ago, and was still trying to do drag, and I was working at a perennial plant farm until they went out of business. And the owner of the nursery, she gave me a greenhouse, and she said, "Go back to doing what you love," because when I was 11 years old, I had about 1,200 varieties of cactus and succulents, and was always a plant lover, and had greenhouses till I was 18, and I lost my greenhouse to a tornado, and so then I left the nest. So I come back to North Carolina, I get back involved in plants, and now I have a beautiful nursery called Growing Green. Located right beside, I built my home right beside my nursery. I have 7 acres of greenhouses and land, and we grow rare and exotic plants from all over the world. And we also have a location at the North Carolina State Farmers Market in Raleigh. 7 days a week, and then my nursery's open 5 days a week.
So what is your favorite exotic plant?
Well, gosh, I'm a plant collector, so I get in trouble when I place orders and stuff sometimes because I end up buying a $3,000 or $4,000 plant for myself. And so my favorite plant is a Thai constellation monstera. It's very special to me, and people, it's very highly sought after. But now I'm getting into a lot of these rare variegated things that are grown in the Amazon rainforest that you barely ever see. And we were fortunate enough just recently to have, we had an event here at our nursery from Ecuador, a company called Ecuagenera. And they carry rare and unusual plants from the Amazon basin. And we had over 1,600 people here from 8 or 9 states. And people traveled to come buy these rare and exotic plants, as well as shop at my nursery. And so we're known for probably having the largest selection of rare and unusual house plants in the 7-state area until you hit Florida.
Well, very cool. That sounds like a great place to be. Now that you're out of the drag world, it sounds like it would be, you know, relaxing and interesting and always new stuff to learn, keep you on your toes.
It does. It does. And I'm happy. I don't miss, I wanted to quit female impersonation when I was still bookable. I still looked good. I still had a good act, because so many entertainers don't know when to stop and hang it up. And I didn't want to be one of those that said, oh, you should come see Scarlett. She's good. Or, you should have seen her in her day. She was good. Bless her heart. I didn't want to be one of those bless your heart stories.
You know, I've heard that from several performers. When I interviewed Raven, Monty Buttery, he's living on a farm in Oklahoma now.
Right.
I spoke to Ziggy Stardust, and he's living on a farm, I think, in Kentucky or somewhere. So several of them have kind of moved out to the country and changed the lifestyle completely. But it sounds like you're doing really well, and I'm really glad that you could have the time today to share some of your stories about these bars in Atlanta and North Carolina, so that everybody can know about them and kind of relive those moments with you.
Thank you, Art, for the opportunity, and I certainly do appreciate it.
That concludes another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show. For more information about this episode, or to find more episodes,